Welcome to Open Source Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, joining in from the Hertz Bunker at an undisclosed location, but still in Guelph. We're never leaving.
The Christmas Bunker.
Technically. Although we have no tree, we have...
Yeah. You have a pole.
We have a pole, yes.
Because you're doing a Festivus for the rest of us.
Yeah, I think Festivus should be a monthly thing, actually. Especially the airing of the grievances, which is something we almost do weekly, really. But
yeah, I was going to say, that's something we do on every show.
Yeah, so it's Festivus every week here on Open Sources. Yeah.
Well, this week it's actually the movie show, but we'll get into that in a second. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and we are here every Thursday at 5 p.m., including on Christmas Eve, to talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world, and sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. But because it is Christmas Eve, and we do this every year over the holiday break, one of the two regular end-of-the-year shows we do is the political movie show. And this is the 6th annual political movie show.
Wow. I know.
I actually took the time and effort and energy to look it up about the, because we had done 5 before. That means that, like, we basically have a top 10 political movies list already.
Right.
So, do you want to hear them?
Sure.
All right. So, running in reverse order from last year, for Scotty Hertz, there's Knock Down the House, the Netflix doc about people running for the House of Representatives, including AOC. Chappaquiddick, which is about Ted Kennedy's scandal in the 70s. Fahrenheit 11-9, Sorry to Bother You. I, Daniel Blake, Saving Capitalism, Suffragette, Wiener, Borgen, and Love. Land and Freedom. So that is the Scotty top 10.
Wow, I'd kind of forgotten about some of those. Thank you for the refresher. Gonna have lots of time over the holidays to watch more movies, so I might dig some of those up again. You never know.
Well, one of the reasons I did all this is because I wanted to make sure I hadn't. I'm not doing any repeats. So here's my list. I have Election, Parasite, They Live, White House Down, Get Out, Don't Mess with the Zohan, Mitt, Dixie Chicks Shut Up and Sing, Head of State, and W.
Wow.
Yeah.
I definitely checked out a couple of those because of your recommendation. And last year was Parasite, which was a fantastic film.
Academy Award.
I think you called it the Scotty Hertz movie of the year. So yeah,
it is the Scotty Hertz movie of the
maybe
year.
Of the lifetime. Yeah, we don't know yet, but
working class people striking back in blood. It's it was the Scotty Hertz feel good movie of the year.
My life. What best reflects your life? Well, Parasite and maybe Shoplifters, but that's yeah.
All right. We should get into this year's picks, and I know what I chose, and since I'm running the show, I'm dying to know what your first pick is, so I'm going to let you go first with your first movie this year.
Okay, well, my first pick, which doesn't involve involve the working class and blood, but not directly, is The New Corporation, which is available on Crave, I believe, and Crave are kind of the brains behind it, and we watched it on iTunes Movies, actually. So The New Corporation, you may remember there was a documentary Canadian made about 20 years ago called The Corporation, which was met with much fanfare it may be a little less than 20 years ago, I can't quite remember, but the people behind that decided that they needed a sequel to that movie because so much has happened in the intervening years, namely the 2008 crash and the rise of technology. So in the initial film, they had determined that if the corporation was a person, which is something that does sort of exist in the States, that corporations would be declared psychopaths if you were following the DSM criteria on defining whether somebody is a psychopath or not. But they've taken that one step further this time around. Not exactly using the DSM criteria, but a bit of a checklist is like, so how is this going now? There's the playbook of corporations in 2020 and the years leading up to now. And it kind of adds to the whole psychopath theory, but now we have corporations in general that want to play nice, to have capitalism with a happy face. So the drive these days is to for corporate people, an example would be Bill Gates and his drive to vaccinate, or you know, other companies that are trying to spin it. BP is another example that they use in the movie, who have a terrible, terrible environmental record, specifically the Deepwater Horizon explosion. Or Clearwater Horizon, sorry, is that right? Clearwater, Deepwater, those two different things.
Deepwater, yeah.
Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah.
Ruined the Gulf of Mexico for, still not determined on how much damage that did, but yet BP will still do this spin, like, well, we're into solar panels, we're into all of these things. So it seems to be all about that these days. Can we have this version of capitalism and corporations, but if we slap a happy face on it, a nice message, or, you know, we are concerned about, you know, name the cause, then that will make it all better. At least that is the theory. Adding to this, and I would say this might be a bit of a critique of this film, or a criticism of this film, was that they tried to jam so much into it that by the end, because, well, so much has happened in the intervening when they started making this film. Then the pandemic hit, so I guess 2020 was supposed to be the editing year, and I think they felt they had to add certain things. So it's easy to tell because everybody is on a remote call for anything that was added into this film. And that's not, it doesn't diminish from it at all, but it kind of distracts from, you know, they decided they had to talk about the pandemic and Black Lives Matter, all very important things, but it just, you could tell that the message was being a bit more drawn out. And I would also add, the opening montage, if you have epilepsy or anything, flashing lights, there's no warning, but I couldn't watch it because they do this really rapid fire of all the corporate logos, because there are so many. And so that's my warning for this film. But still, so just kind of forward through the little bit, or first bit, or close your eyes, because it is almost impossible to watch. And of course, a lot of it is interviews with people, wide ranging. Like they spoke to a lot, and actually managed to get some corporate types involved with it. But then, considering that it's a Canadian film, and of course has at the end you see the Canada logo, so I think there was some government money involved. Although it was. I believe it was a Crave original production. Bell Media were involved. Rogers. These are actually some of the companies that they didn't address them specifically, but is that kind of thing that we'd be critical of, right? Like Bell's campaign for it's Let's Talk, right? So anyway, bit of an aside there, but I'm just, you know, you could essentially incorporate some of the corporations that back this into the film. CanCon wise, I spoke to Elizabeth May and Grand Chief Stuart Phillips in BC, and they were mostly talking about the environmental situation in BC, like I was alluding to with BP and others, or companies that want to clear cut, yet they will somehow do something that makes it seem like they're environmental heroes. Because, and this is my opinion too, that, you know, the kind of green capitalism thing just isn't going to cut it. And it becomes quite clear in watching something like this, that you just because you're saying these things and you're giving $1 million to so-and-so whilst doing all of these other things, not in the background at all, they're not hiding it. You know, it's completely unsustainable. And then again, one of the, not a divergent thread, but it's, they get into media, which is something we love, and media control of everything, and how, you know, the usual suspects, Facebook, Skype, etc. Skype, we're on Skype. I meant Twitter. There's just so many choices. How these operations control messaging, and how corporations have harnessed that messaging and directed a certain way in their favor, of course. So There's a lot there. There's a lot to unpack. So sorry if I spoke for too long there, but it's so action packed with the things that it covers. It's almost impossible to just say, well, it's about this, right? So
yeah,
it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, there were a lot of like agitators that came back this year. And I guess maybe it had to do with the American election, too. But you had the Yes Men coming back and making a new movie, and Borat, too, which turned out to be much more political than it might have otherwise, or than maybe Sacha Baron Cohen intended. Because thinking about the first Borat, it's not very political at all. It's just about, you know, trying to offend as many people as humanly possible. But Borat, too, had a point, and it kind of addressed a lot of those same things about corporate control and misinformation sources, that kind of thing.
I would say Borat 2 is probably a runner-up for one of my picks. I absolutely loved it. I didn't get through Borat 1, but Borat 2 was like, yeah, this went to a place that I can really relate to. So
yeah, it's I'm almost surprised that it took them. I mean, I'm surprised in a couple of reasons. Number one, it took them like almost 20 years to come back around to this, because things haven't gotten better. It's gotten worse in a sense. And then second, that it's Crave that is the person who, or the corporation that's kind of sponsoring this, because like Bell is kind of a megacore in its own, like it not wanting to share its its fiber network and the way it kind of buys up a whole bunch of TV stations and homogenizes them. It's, you know, it's impossible to see a difference. I mean, if you're flipping through your TV guide on your TV, if you're going past like the Bell Media stations, and they're all branded now, like CTV Life, CTV Drama, CTV Sci-Fi, it's like, well, they have all the same like five shows. If you want to watch House anytime, it's either on CTV Life or CTV Drama, or I'm surprised it's not on CTV Sci-Fi, because it will be eventually, because they have the rights to House. Might as well squeeze as much juice out of it as you can.
CTV's main channel, not to beat on CTV too heavily, but they do this teaser thing on conventional TV where they'll show like one or two episodes of something. Specifically Star Trek Discovery, which was something we started watching, and then they're like, oh no, you have to go to this channel to get it. So it's almost like a, you know, the old media is just advertising for the rest of what they do. So,
right.
But, and that is an example that leads back to this new corporation, which is, it's surprising that they gave it this much. That's what's, I think the original one was just an independent production, right? I don't know who bankrolled it. Probably the same thing. You get the Canada Media Grant and the Ontario and the Quebec one or whatever, and then you make a film. But this was a little bit different. So in some weird, ironic way, maybe this was Bell and Crave's way of doing the exact thing that the movie describes and is critical of, right? So it's I don't know. To me, it's one of those things that proves that we, you know, not to toot our own horn too much, but we are allowed complete free reign in what we do and what we say generally within reason and within the law, obviously. But it just kind of proves that this kind of channel is very necessary in this day and age, especially, right? So,
Okay, my turn. So I went to the old, actually, because I have so much physical media.
You're one of the kings in this town.
For physical media?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know if any of you have ever seen Adam on Zoom or whatever, but man, that room is... You've got the shelves already ready to go for the when they interview you about something, whereas I'm in this crypt here. I got to put a blanket up. Sorry, let her rip.
No. It's okay. So I did go to the shelves, and I dusted off a couple of that I'm kind of embarrassed I haven't made the list so far. So this first one is Lincoln. I thought it was a timely choice. From 2012, directed by Steven Spielberg, based on the book Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin. I think it is probably Steven Spielberg's last really great movie that he's put out. I mean, I can't say about West Side Story because it's been delayed till next year. Oh. But so it could be his next great movie. I don't know. But for now, Lincoln is the last great one. Stars Daniel Day-Lewis as the titular character. Also, it's just like a great cast all around. There's a lot of really great character actors in it. But the great thing that Spielberg does is that he just focuses on like a 1 month period, and Lincoln's like perhaps the most consequential month, which is the passage of the 13th Amendment in January 1865. The Civil War is winding down. It's a interestingly, because it's a lame duck Congress in the movie. The Republicans are about to take over the House, which means they could probably fairly easily pass the 13th Amendment in the new Republican House. But Lincoln pushes forward to make, you know, to make it as bipartisan as possible. And the thing that, you know, it reminds you, and there's a great line that kind of sums it up, and I wrote it down, and I hope I can find it quickly, that Thaddeus Stevens says. Thaddeus Stevens was like a famously big abolitionist, like not just eliminating slavery, but, you know, giving black people equal rights. Mm-hmm. It's even rumored, and the movie does hint at this, that Thaddeus Stevens was married to the woman who pretended to be his housekeeper, but was really his wife, and she was black. And the movie kind of hints at that, but the line that Stevens says is, "The greatest measure of the 19th century passed by corruption, aided and abetted by the purest man in America," which is basically what the story is, that these three guys are hired lobbyists, basically, to go to these lame duck Democrats who are going to be out of a job in a couple of months and basically bribe them with patronage appointments to get them to vote in favor of the amendment, or to otherwise abstain. They need a supermajority in the House of 2/3 to pass a constitutional amendment. And so it's funny to watch these guys operate while Lincoln, you know, cannot tell a lie, is using these just like down and dirty, corrupt guys who, there's a line early on where the Secretary of State Seward meets with the lobbyists. And one of them, who's played by James Spader, says, you know, it's just easy. Like, congressmen are cheap, you know, they'll take money. Like, why are we bothering with patronage appointments? We'll just give them money.
Just bribe them outright. Yeah.
Just bribe them. Yeah. It's so funny to hear people talk so openly about, I guess, the looseness of how politicians can be bought, even like almost 200 years ago. We tend to think we're better now, but the fact of the matter is, you know, politicians are still bought. We're just kind of more dainty about it. But it's also kind of a reminder. We're going into a situation in the United States where we talk about how it's more divided than ever. Well, there was no time more divided than Congress, than the Civil War. And Congress, even in the United States, was a reflection of that at a time. The Democrats were very anti-abolitionist in 1865. And there's another great line in it, too, where Lincoln is talking about if people are born into the times, like the right people are born into this, into the time, or do the times shape the people? And I feel like that's something very much going on with Joe Biden right now, is just the stark contrast and difference between his style and Donald Trump's style. Is he the person who was kind of molded to come in this time of great division and great upheaval because of his basic decency? And of course, Biden understands tragedy in a way very similar to Lincoln. Lincoln lost his beloved mother when he was very young. His middle son, Willie, some people say his favorite son, passed away from typhus while they were in the White House. You know, similar to Biden, Biden lost his first wife and his daughter when he was elected to the Senate, famously took his oath at the hospital as he looked after his sons, lost his son Beau while he was vice president. You know, it's hard. not that you want to say Joe Biden and Lincoln are analogous, but it's hard not to recognize the comparisons of two men born into tragedy, sort of forced into a position of leadership at like the most divided time in their lifetimes. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, will, you know, 100 years from now, they be making movies about Joe Biden during this time period? I don't know, but it's interesting to think about.
Well, we'll see how COVID goes, right? Because I think that is it is the battle of the times. I know it's a different universe from the American Civil War, but that was a good one. I can't actually believe that was 2012, but so it goes. And if I remember right, what is Daniel Day-Lewis not amazing in, right? And I take it didn't he retire or something? Isn't he officially? People say those kinds of things. I think. Who is it? There's lots of people famously retire, like Sean Connery from Bond, but comes back. So we may see Daniel Day-Lewis in something again if the role is right, I suppose. But yeah, that's after all of these years, they're still unpacking the Civil War, and not just the, you know, the elements of slavery and why it happened. There was obviously way more to it than just that, and it didn't, you know. That didn't actually fix everything, right? If anything, was that what? How did Churchill put it? The end of the beginning, right? It's just when things started to roll. But yeah, that's a great recommendation. I wouldn't say completely forgotten about it, but it is amazing the parallels to today. How, like, on one of those all science things where everybody evokes Lincoln, right? Mm. I think Trump has done it, you know, one of his favorites and being a Republican, but I don't think Lincoln was anywhere near the type of Republican. Well, Trump is the exception, right? But it's just, I guess if enough time passes, then your heroes can become just whomever, right? It doesn't really matter. Their party affiliation doesn't matter in the scheme of things. But yeah, it's also interesting that we mentioning how the Democrats were pro-slavery. Like, they don't want to talk about that, right? And for years and years, too, it wasn't just, you know, the Civil War happened and then everything was okay. It was like, so.
Right. And the movie goes into like these ripples, these divisions within the Republican Party itself. It wasn't like a united party purely against slavery. You know, there were people who wanted basically they wanted Abraham Lincoln to focus on ending the war, and there's a subplot about Confederate negotiators coming to Washington to sue for peace, and Lincoln's getting it from all sides, like, well, you should make a peace instead of squandering all your time and political capital on trying to get the 13th Amendment passed. And you know, the point is, and this is often forgotten, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free the slaves. It freed slaves in rebel states. And so what happens when those rebel states become members of the United States again? You know, so there was a kind of, you know, walk before you can crawl mentality to what Lincoln was trying to do. And, you know, it's one of these movies, too. And I was thinking about another presidential movie, 13 Days, which is about the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's one of these things where it's like, what is leadership? How do people like Lincoln, like Kennedy, you know, make it seem like, you know, they're making these big decisions, they're managing these huge crises, they make like quick decisions that seem like they're moving on a dime, but they've actually been set up for weeks or years, like you're watching the dominoes fall. What insight do these men have that makes them great leaders in this time of crisis? And then you think of Trump too, who, you know, in this time of crisis, all he had to do was take one piece of paper that had the best medical advice from scientists, hand it to his public policy people and say, do that. And he can't execute. It's just, you know, the qualities of leadership is, you know, what kind of goes on in the heads of leaders is a big question that I kind of always think about, like, what hand kind of guides them through these multifaceted crises, and what separates a success from failure? Obvious, like, sometimes very slim measures, too. And, you know, Lincoln kind of is one of those movies that makes you think about all that.
Yeah, and I remember, was it Grant? Who played General Grant? This is Jared me thinking Harris. back. that was a great performance. Here's me remembering 8 years later that like that was solid. So and Sally Field as well, right? As Mrs. Lincoln.
Yeah, Sally Field.
Yeah,
is
you
Mary
said that
Todd.
Off the top. Yeah, so yeah. It's like there was some beyond the whole story. There's some fantastic performances in this, and I think that is probably Spielberg's strong suit is bringing out those performances in people in an epic story like this, right? So
yeah, absolutely. It's such a great cast, like from top to bottom, and like there are people you recognize, like maybe David Strathairn who plays Seward, or Walton Goggins, who's one of the Democratic Congress people. There's also like Tim Blake Nelson, Peter McRobbie, who plays one of the Democratic congressmen, David Constable. I mean, these are faces you would recognize when you see them, but you may not know their names. But
they're not necessarily stars outright, but you do. Oh, there's that guy. And there's that guy.
It's a really killer cast.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of killers, we have to take a commercial break or we're going to get killed. We're going to take a break and then come back with our number two picks. You are listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca. Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
And that was Sinner Man by Nina Simone, a song which finds itself in many, many things, including every other TV series that people are streaming, several movies, and it is really out there. Not out there, but what it's in its entirety, it's 10 minutes long. I highly recommend people check it out because there is a lot going on there. It is a fantastic, fantastic song, and I think that's why it appears in so many things, including my next pick.
Ooh, since you've queued that up, why don't you get right into it?
Sure. The film is The Front Runner, which is on Netflix. Yeah. Is it a Netflix original? I'm not sure. But of course, with everybody not getting out too much and Netflix getting to know what we like to watch under my films you may like, The Front Runner came up. I was like, hey, is that Hugh Jackman? It was indeed Hugh Jackman as Gary Hart, Senator Gary Hart. And those of us like Adam and I that are old enough to remember, this was a major, major scandal in the late 1980s. Gary Hart was a contender to the presidential throne on the Democrat side, but after having an affair that was exposed by journalists, his campaign unraveled completely, and The Front Runner tells this story, not necessarily from Gary Hart's perspective, actually not at all. And the part that I really liked about this film was that most of the films like this, there's a certain structure, and you and I, Adam, have watched a lot of them. I'm going to say from All the President's Men on up, where it's the split between the political that's going on, the journalists and those that cover the story and expose the story. There are a ton of films like this, like Bombshell was a fairly good one, which would be a runner up for me. Spotlight. I would probably even include Network in that. But of course, the template for it all was All the President's Men, where you have this political intrigue going on. You have a parallel story of journalists doing what they do. And to me, that was the best part of this film was the analysis of that and the portrayal of journalism in the late 1980s, where it is the point where it is transitioning to our modern era. It was a kind of a long arc, and I would say beyond technology, although it's great to see all the old tech that they've dug up from the 80s, which might seem old to you kids, but I remember when a fax machine was a big deal, teletype, ashtrays in the place still, the bottle of scotch in the desk, that kind of thing. And packed newsrooms as well, right? There's this whole machine. And even smaller towns, and that's what they... Not smaller towns. Let me explain. Like, the Washington Post covered this extensively when it happened and blew the story wide open, but also the Miami Herald. And... Yeah, among others, but they were the ones to crack it. And something that they generally have to do in films like this is condense it and hybridize characters, which I don't necessarily like when you find out that somebody who seems, you know, they play a great character in a film and then you realize that they weren't actually real, but they were a hybrid of two or three things. They did this in the Rob Ford movie. They do this in films to kind of compress it, because it'd probably be like 8 hours long if they broke down every single character. So they did this on both sides of the story, and I'm just trying to think of the names of the hybrids. Well, anyway, first of all, Vera Farmiga is the long-suffering wife. J.K. Simmons as the campaign manager, Gary Hart's campaign manager. I think his name was Bill Dixon. Oscar winner, right? He is fantastic in everything. Mm-hmm. Like, as a supporting guy, and he has had lead roles as well, but he nails it as the not angry campaign manager, but somebody that's trying to steer a story that is spiraling completely out of control. And for those who don't know, I mean, Gary Hart was absolutely wiped out by this story. And it's mm-hmm. the kind of story that you, these days, as we know, under the Trump era, that you wouldn't necessarily get wiped out for being unfaithful to your wife. This was a much bigger deal than the 1980s. So somebody's portraying himself as a family man, and it was also the era where and they do allude to it a couple of times, the photo op, which Gary Hart doesn't seem to like too much, where you need to present yourself as this, you know, wonderful corn-fed soul with a couple of kids, and he didn't like that at all. And it's possible that he didn't like it because he was being, you know, unfaithful. He was having the Donna Rice was the main affair that is covered in this, but it, you know, they strongly imply and allude to that there were others. And like I said, now that probably wouldn't matter. But so the other standouts in the film, I think, were Molly Ephraim, who plays the scheduler, I think, of Gary Hart, but she's also a bit of a mm-hmm. fixer. And there's this mm-hmm. interplay between her and Donna Rice, and gets pretty heavy there. And also, I knew I was going to blow his name. Mamoudou Athi plays the hybridized character from the Washington Post, who is a reporter who represents Tour 3. He has been in, I can't think of anything offhand, but another, again, like we were talking about the other movie, the people that are in a ton of stuff and you say, oh, it's that person.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very good. But yeah, it's one of those stories for, again, I guess for our age, even though it had happened, you know, 3-4 decades ago, and directed by Jason Reitman, who was Juno, right? Mm-hmm. Thank you for Smoking. That's another great film.
Yeah.
And I will default to the end credits person for other movies that Jason Reitman has done, because I'm like, I don't know. But he is a name. It is around. So it's very watchable, but it is the kind of thing you have to take with a grain of salt. It's like, if you do like we all do and hit the internet after something, you realize, I guess it's kind of like The Crown, right? It's like, did any of that happen? Well, some of it did, but then we've added this to it, right? So, you know, you can't necessarily take this, unless it's a documentary, the story at face value, but very entertaining and a good watch, I would say.
Yeah, it's been a good year for like the political biopic, because there's been so many of them. I wouldn't say it's been a good year for the political biopic. I mean, I haven't seen The Front Runner, so it may be the exception rather than the rule. But that, like the Run This Town, the Rob Ford movie you mentioned, is just just drek. It is drek. It is
it's that type of film done wrong. And we watched it, of course. I mean, we had to, right? Like, just we need to watch this film. And that was. I think we've talked about this before, but Robin Doolittle was hybridized out of it, where I think standalone, she would have been an excellent character. Just put her in the film. And Daniel Dale, right? I mean, those were the two people who have gone on to bigger and greater things. I don't know why they felt they needed to. Anyway,
it may be a rights thing, because into a
completely different film, which I feel we've spoken about, but that's the example of a film done in this mold that's not done the best. And this is based on a book. But if you do a bit of the digging, a lot of the reviews of the book itself is that The Front Runner is that the book is flawed in its analysis of what happened. So if you're getting this movie out of something that's, you know, not necessarily the best representation of what went on. So you know, the end product is the result of that. but still very watchable, you know, considering the times, right? Everybody's hitting the Netflix every day these days, right? So,
well, it's interesting to, as you say, to look back at a day when, you know, Gary, you know, a lot of presidential figures had affairs, you know, Roosevelt, famously, Franklin Roosevelt, I should say, you know, Kennedy. It was a part of life, and nobody wrote about it. And this,
yeah, because they didn't. That's what happens in this. I think this was the modern turning point of that, where it's like we are going to report all this. And the stakeout of Gary Hart's place by the reporters is comedy gold. It's probably the best part of the film, I think, where they they do this kind of police style trying to track down what's going on, and, you know, his comings and goings and who is going in and out. And it's probably the best, you know, the comedy relief of the movie. So, but yeah, so that's, you add all these elements and you get whatever you get. And sometimes it really, really works. But as a period piece, it's excellent, you know, because I remember 1988. I don't know if that's, it's probably easier to do period pieces that are closer in time, you know, rather than Lincoln's time. Although Lincoln looked excellent, it's like when you know, you just need to go to the thrift store to get the props you need, pretty much, right? Whereas if there is a thrift store open in the red zones. But yeah, this was obviously made before all things locked down, but yeah, wonderful to see.
That's a good pick. For my second pick, I went with something similarly themed to Lincoln, but almost 100 years, almost exactly 100 years later. So I chose Selma, which is the 2014 part biopic, part as it happened, you know, dramatic recreation of the voter rights protests in Alabama. The movie Selma, directed by Ava DuVernay, of course, who is a very talented filmmaker, one of the few kind of working, unfortunately, one of the few working black female filmmakers, at least in terms of directors who are given substantial budgets to work with. She's one of the few, if not one of the only, who is given a great deal of creative freedom, sadly. Not sadly for her, because she's great, but sadly that's kind of the way it's
that you being. Could only name one. Yeah.
Yeah. That you can only name one, basically. Yeah. I mean, and also, like, in terms of like big female directors, it's like that are like probably household names. It's like Ava DuVernay and Catherine Bigelow. And it's because Catherine Bigelow also has an Oscar, but, Selma. So it's, like I said, it's part biopic, cause it's about, Dr. King and his leadership and his advocacy through this period. It is part sort of, it focuses more on Dr. King, more than just on Dr. King, but sort of the broader political and social circumstances that are going on around the march and around the struggle to get voting rights in Alabama for black people, and eventually the passage of the voting rights bill. You have portions of the film with George Wallace, who's in the movie played by Tim Roth. You have portions with LBJ, who's played by Tom Wilkinson. Maybe one of the best movie LBJs, I think.
There's been a few, right? Yeah.
There's been a few. And also, he's an Englishman, so it's kind of interesting that he's able to channel
and Texas. So is Tim Roth, and they all have that accent, yes. Right? They all just kind of talk like this, yeah.
That is interesting, come to think of it now, that you have that the American the white American politicians in this are played by Englishmen. But the thing that's striking about it is it plays like any number of political biopics you've ever seen about like white political figures. So it is very much of a tradition with that, except it is about MLK. One of the things that sticks out about it is just how explicit it deals with violence, especially the violence against the black people in Alabama. Like the scene on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the Bloody Sunday scene is just harrowing to watch. to watch. The actor is Stephen James, but he's playing young John Lewis. And so to watch him get, you know, so thoroughly smoked on the back of the head that his skull cracks, that is...
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially this year after John Lewis's pass is kind of especially harrowing. But I mean, there's also the beginning of the film is King receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, and it's juxtaposed against the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. Sorry, it kind of tripped over my tongue. The 16th Street Baptist Church in Montgomery, where four little girls were killed. So, you know, that's also a very harrowing sequence to not just like the violence of it, but to compare and contrast like this moment of triumph for King personally and for his leadership of the movement against like what's going on back in the States, just like the worst possible kind of violence against kids. And then later on when we see, the night march in Selma, and the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson, who is in the movie, he's played by Lakeith Stanfield, who you would know because he's in Sorry to Bother You.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He's also been in a ton of things too, Short Term 12, and what was he in this year? He was in something. Anyway,
Not sure, but again, one of those faces that's one of those you see everywhere. Yeah.
One of those faces. But, you know, that scene, because in real life, Jimmie Lee Jackson, his mother and his grandfather were taking part in the night march, and then the police come out and start doing what the police in Selma, Alabama, in 1965 did when groups of black people got together to peacefully protest. They ran, they ducked into a black-owned diner, and then the state police came in to roust them, and in the process Jimmie Lee Jackson was shot dead. And the movie pulls no punches. It is shocking to watch. It is upsetting to watch. I mean, Ava DuVernay, obviously because she's a black woman herself, knows what buttons to push in a scene like this. And I again, like you, I did a little internet research after I watched it. I was like, because I was wondering, like, is this playing out kind of as it did? And it turns out, yes, this is more or less how it happened. On top of that, I found out that the Alabama state trooper that shot Jimmie Lee Jackson was not identified till 2005. And the officer's name was Bernard Fowler. And he basically confessed. I mean, it was almost like a deathbed confession because he was so old at that point. But yeah, it's just like, when you think about that, when you think about, I mean, people know that the attack on the Baptist church that killed the little girls, that wasn't resolved until decades later because the person who put those criminals behind bars was Doug Jones, the recently ousted senator from Alabama. It just, you know, it's impossible to shake the, I mean, that feeling that, because a lot of this stuff is still happening in the sense that we're only getting justice for some of these acts until like very, very recently, 50 years later. it's like literally 50 years later that this officer Fowler was arrested and tried for shooting Jimmie Lee Jackson in the stomach while he was unarmed in a diner. It's incredible to just, and you know, it makes you realize why this is still so visceral to a lot of people, these issues of equality. It's because it's still going on, not the acts themselves, but I mean just the waiting for justice for some of these acts too.
Yeah, you know, and considering the times, it, like you say, something happening in the past, kind of like Lincoln, and then but having an effect in the future as well. I mean, over the past few years, what we've seen with Black Lives Matter, when you see the opening scene of Selma, and I have seen some of it, but we had a network failure when I started watching it and never picked it up again. But of course, I'm going to now. Of course, it's shortlisted. I still need to. I think it left Netflix and came back. It doesn't matter. It's back. Okay, so we'll find it somewhere. I think that's what happened. But yeah, very powerful stuff right at the beginning, and that's you're right. Like people don't realize. They have this image of the 60s and this peace and love thing and all that well, not crap, but that there's this there's this image that we are left with because of media in the future of the 60s. But yeah, this was massive. And you were talking about the violence. When you think about the, including King, people, civil rights leaders that were assassinated, the Kennedys, King himself, Malcolm X, it's Medgar Evers. It's an endless, and bombing a church where children died, and Angela Davis is from Birmingham, and she had said that shaped her entire direction of her life, because she knew some of the people that were in that bombing. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's not any one event that propels these things forward, as we've seen with Black Lives Matter and the several things come together to reach ahead. And it's not as if civil rights campaigning happened overnight in America as well, but it is an absolutely amazing story to see. And again, it's like anything, if I understand it right, there will be some historic, like, there's the people that really know the story will look at it and say, well, you know, that didn't actually happen. But you have to, it's not a complete work of fiction, but some liberties, I think, have to be taken to get it into the 2-hour package, right? So they're not going to get, they're not going to get absolutely everything right. But from what I remember of it with Selma, it was an amazing, not just an amazing looking thing, because I guess they can still go to the Edward Pettus Bridge?
Yep. Yeah, like, it's still there. Yeah,
that wasn't a set, was it? They were actually there.
They were there.
Like, they went back to the scene,
the crime, as it were. Yeah.
Well, yeah, to film that, and that seeing it again when John Lewis passed this year, it's like, wow, that is definitely something else.
Yeah, it was definitely on the actual Edmund Pettus Bridge, and there's like this act. There's what in the. The second attempt at the march after Bloody Sunday, where King was leading it, there's this slow pan up over the trellis of the bridge to see the lines of people marching, to see how long it was. And it's also very pointedly, you know, Duvernay saying, like, yeah, I know I'm making a movie, but this is where it actually happened. This is where stuff went. This is where stuff went down. And there is, you're right about the whole the violence, the violence being treated as like kind of a constant companion in this movie. There's you're kind of reminded of that because Jimmie Lee Jackson's funeral, which King spoke at, it was at the same church that Malcolm X spoke at like a month earlier. And there's a quick scene with Malcolm X in it where he's talking to Coretta Scott King. But Malcolm X was assassinated during this period, and it was like a couple of weeks after he was in Selma, after King and the other leaders were arrested the first time. So I mean, it's top of mind throughout the rest of the movie, and there's actually a scene near the end where King is talking to a representative from the government. I think it's based on a real person, John Doerr. Who was a member of the Justice Department, and he was one of the, he worked in the civil rights branch for years, so he was definitely kind of an ally, where he says to King, he's trying to talk King out of making a speech on the State House steps at the end of the march, and, you know, because they can't guarantee his safety because of, you know, all the violence that has happened, all the violence that is going down. And indeed, at the end of the movie, when you see the like a lot of biopics they have at the end, like, this is what happened to so-and-so.
What happened to so-and-so, yeah.
But one of the people they highlight is Viola Luzzo, who was a white woman who was also very actively involved in the civil rights movement. But she was killed, like, within hours after that march to... the successful march to the Capitol in Montgomery. She was driving people back to Selma and was murdered in the process. And it's like, you know, you talk a lot about all the protests that happened this year, like the marches and the demonstrations. And I mean, there were some brutal parts in places like Lafayette Square in Washington, where they mm-hmm. cleared people out with tear gas. And I mean, you know, there are some fairly brutal protests, but like the idea of like, just, you know, you're driving people home and you're murdered, you know, there were people murdered for sure, but it doesn't happen with like the alarming frequency like it did in the 60s. You know, that the idea of like pushing for civil rights can literally, you know, put you on death's door. Like it's like this kind of dangerous, violent activity that could result in your death. It's just remarkable anyone came out of the 50s or the 60s alive, for that matter. But it is a reminder that these fights are not, well, that they are A, not clean, B, not necessarily fair, and C, that when you were talking about, you know, equal rights, there is always a danger that some people are not going to take that the way you hope it will, and it could result in violence, if not death. And I mean, that's the monkey on the back through this whole movie, is like, who doesn't make it out of 1955 alive, almost? And of course, we know, you didn't need the thing at the end to know that Dr. King doesn't make it to see his dream come to fruition alive, that mm-hmm. he is assassinated in 68. I mean, the movie reminds you of that, but I don't think anyone watching this movie needs reminding that somebody with a gun killed Dr. King long before he saw equality really come to fruition. That, you know, 4 years after this, he was gone, and that's just the way it was.
Yeah, and I was thinking back to, as you were talking there, I was thinking back to Mississippi Burning.
Yeah.
Not a companion piece at all. That's a long time ago. I think that film might be from the 80s, but it talked mm-hmm. about the civil rights workers or they're trying to sign people up to vote, just some young people that had been called from all parts of the states and ended up murdered. It's just, it's an unbelievable, considering that the civil rights movement, King was very big on nonviolence, inspired by Gandhi, mm-hmm. right? He was like, mm-hmm. you know, we are just going to go, we are going to put ourselves in this position, you know, no guns, no weapons. And yet the full force of everything was brought down upon them, and can, you know, in some ways continues to be, as you said, today, maybe not the frequency of the assassinations of the leaders, but definitely the culture of violence mm-hmm. in this situation still exists. No one should be under any doubt that, you know, they will beat, you will get beaten, march like that, you will get beaten on if, you know, the conditions are right, so.
And it's not even just the violence too. Like, there's a scene near the beginning where a woman goes to sign up to vote, and you know, black people were allowed to vote, but there were barriers thrown up against them. And so she goes and hands in her forms to this guy, and he's like, okay, you know, name all the Superior Court judges in Alabama. And that's kind of like he's just throwing up conditions to make sure that she can't vote. And it's like, dude, can you name all the Superior Court judges in Alabama? Could anyone? That's just sort of like how blatant the racism and the barriers to voting they were. And it took a heck of a lot of guts to walk in and register to vote if you were a black person to begin with. And this is where Ava DuVernay was really, really smart with her casting, because this is like the second or third scene in the movie, but the woman she cast as this woman trying to register to vote is Oprah Winfrey, who of course everybody recognizes.
Yeah.
And so you immediately set up this dynamic, like, here is, in the back of your head, here is Oprah, maybe the most powerful black woman in the world. And, you know, here she is playing a character facing this kind of like really blatant discrimination. It's really quite clever the way she uses casting in that regard and eliciting that sympathy.
I sometimes forget about Oprah as actress, but yeah, that's definitely got quite the resume.
Yeah, Color Purple is, I mean, it's not, to go back to Spielberg, mm-hmm. it is not his best, but it is maybe his boldest move, considering where he was in his career. He maybe wasn't ready to make it, but I appreciate it. I appreciate the effort. It's not a great movie, but it's not terrible either. It's an interesting movie, The Color Purple. I guess we'll have to wrap that up. That's the end of our movie show. And we hope you liked it. And stay connected to us on our website, opensourcesguelph.com, or on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. You can listen to the show again by downloading it from our website every Monday, or on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. And if you just randomly Google me, you'll probably find me somehow. So if you're looking for me, you'll find me. And of course, it's CFRU, CFRU.ca.
CFRU.ca, where there will be more, maybe not explicitly Christmas programming, but since tomorrow is Christmas, Merry Christmas to everyone. Merry Christmas to you, Scotty.
And to you, sir. Happy holidays and stay safe. This is what I tell everybody now. It's my end greeting now. Is like, stay safe, people, please.
And definitely stay safe, because we will be back next week with our end of the year award show. So until then, we will see you next week for our New Year's Eve spectacular.